Hello, and welcome to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine, broadcasting from the Sanctuary for Independent Media in Troy, New York, on the unceded homelands of the Mohican people, known today as the Stockbridge-Munsee community. I'm Sina Bazila-Hickey.
And I'm Mark Dunley. Today on the Hudson Mohawk Magazine, we start with a report on the rally at the Capitol on Wednesday, organized by the local Muslim community in support of a ceasefire in Gaza. Then, for our Peace Bucket, we hear about the 21st Annual Grannies for Peace Mother's Day Vigil, which will take place this Saturday at the Tulip Festival in Albany. Then, for this week's Our Mayo on the Brink, Rosemary reports on how shrinking lawns and planting flowers can combat climate change and environmental degradation with Judith Federley. After that, Moses Nagel shares excerpts from a recent Albany Common Council meeting on issues around the Civilian Complaint Police Review Board. And finally, Marshall Hildreth talks with the American Lung Association in observance of the Turquoise Takeover and Lung Cancer Action Week. But first, headlines.
The Times Union reports that the future of Clearwater, which musician Pete Seeger helped start to restore the Hudson River, is very much in doubt. After years of financial shortfalls, the group has announced that if it does not raise $250,000 within the next 2 months, it will become insolvent and shut down. The group has an annual budget of $1.5 million.
After more than a century, Boy Scouts of America is rebranded as Scout in America. The organization is adopting a more inclusive message, and girls have been joining throughout its rank. Membership dropped by half during the pandemic, down to $1 million. Its high point was 1972, with 5 million members.
The 20th annual Troy River Fest is returning to River Street on Sunday, May 19th, from 11 a.m. to 5 p.m. The festival includes music, food, and craft vendors, and more.
Channel 10 reports that just over 50% of the private water pipes in Troy have been tested for lead over the last 4 months. Water pipes were tested by various city official community groups and volunteers in a door-to-door canvassing effort. The city is working to educate homeowners about the dangers of drinking water from lead pipes and the replacement program. Homeowners can have pipes tested and replaced for free by calling the Department of Public Utilities at 518-237-0611.
Niskayuna is nearing the completion of the process of acquiring Mohawk River State Park from the state, with the town to maintain more than 100 acres of parkland forever wild as part of the agreement.
The Gazette reports that plans to construct a full-service grocery store, as well as other retail outlets and housing, on a two-acre parcel between Albany and State Streets in Schenectady that once was home to a car sales lot is continuing to progress. Schenectady County lawmakers will shortly transfer ownership of the property near the Hamilton Hill and Vale neighborhoods to the Capital Region Land Bank, which will oversee the redevelopment of the property. And that's it for headlines.
Israel is preparing to launch a new ground assault in Gaza as Hamas pushes for a ceasefire negotiated by Egypt to be implemented. Earlier this Wednesday, several hundred people gathered at the Capitol for a rally organized by the local Muslim community. Mark filed this report.
On Wednesday, May 8th, several hundred people gathered at the state capitol at a rally organized by the local Muslim community to support the call for a ceasefire in Gaza. We hear from three of the main organizers of the event, Jamaica Miles of All of Us, Inman Jamal Shah of the Schenectady Islamic Center, and Dr. Shabib Shakima, who is the MC of the event.
Jamaica Miles, co-founder, executive director of All of Us, who is an affiliated member of Movement for Black Lives.
And why are you here today, Jamaica, at this Muslim support rally, ceasefire in Gaza at the state capitol?
All of us is here today because we've stood in unity in the fight to free Palestine from the very beginning. And as an affiliated member of the Movement for Black Lives, that is one of our pillars. It's freedom and liberation for all of us, not just some of us. So when the Muslim leadership reached out and asked if we would be a part of it, we were more than happy to be here because we do truly believe that it is necessary for everyone to have freedom and liberation and not for anyone to be oppressed or exploited.
Now, I understand that the Schenectady City Council hasn't quite passed a resolution yet.
So in the city of Schenectady, we've shown up at every city council meeting for almost 2 months now. We will be back there on Monday the 13th, demanding that they have a ceasefire resolution. And what's really interesting is the resolution that was presented to the city council does not just say that there should be a ceasefire specifically for Palestine, but it also recognizes the atrocity that happened on October 7th, something the city council did not address at the time. So the resolution that's been put forward actually calls out the violence that happened on October 7th, as well as the ongoing violence that continues today by Israel. So here's an opportunity for the city council to stand up for all of us and say that we need justice and liberation. We need an end to violence, regardless of who you are.
And what do we need the Biden administration to be doing at this point?
Well, I think it's been said before, but of course I'll say it again. No more weapons to Israel. They are violating both international and They are violating both international and national law. In our country, it says that if you use weapons against civilians, we're not going to give you weapons anymore. And I'm being really, general about it, but that's what it says. So we're violating our own laws. If Biden really cared about the laws that govern this country, then he would follow them as well.
Thank you very much, Jamaica Miles.
Well, my name is Jamal Shah. I'm the Imam of the Schenectady Islamic Center. We're here today to protest against the ongoing genocide that the Israeli government is enacting upon the people of Gaza and Palestine as a whole. It's been 200 plus days. And the number of dead has been kept at 35,000 probably since January. So we're probably talking an uncountable number of people that have been murdered. So simply we're here today exercising our First Amendment right to protest against that and to speak out against it. As we can see around the country, more and more people are waking up to the realization that there is a very real apartheid and genocide happening within our lifetime. And as the other day was just Holocaust Remembrance Day, it's even more reason for us to speak out loud and unequivocally to ensure that we don't have another, million, 2 million, 3 million, 4 million, 5 million deaths on our hands.
So besides, a ceasefire, what needs to happen at this point? How do we get lasting peace here?
Well, the answer is pretty clear. It's not a complicated situation. We need to input some pressures on the Israeli government to do things that a democracy would do, namely end the occupation, namely recognize the state of Palestine, namely stop the savagery and the butchery. And as the United States government, that is the world superpower. That is the superpower that enables Israel, that also can disable Israel. So we want our elected officials to actually represent the interests of the people and not the interests of themselves.
Most of our elected officials at this point, especially at the federal level, but here at the Capitol, don't seem to be listening. Why is that?
To simplify it, there is a certain lobby that goes around that actually pays our Congress members and state-level officials as well to act in their interests. This lobby is called AIPAC. The irony is that AIPAC is funded by the Israeli government. The irony about the Israeli government is that that money is U.S. taxpayer dollars. So we have taxpayer dollars going to Israel, then coming back to the United States, but not back into the interest of the taxpayer, but into the pockets of elected officials. And then they promote whatever propaganda they're told to promote. As the U.S. taxpayer being at the center of all this, it feels like we're getting a pretty big middle finger saying, your money is now our money, and you get no say in what policies we decide to promote, what policies we decide to enact. And I think as an American citizen, law-abiding citizen, taxpayer, I find that highly problematic, and I just don't know that there's any Americans that are okay with their tax dollars being spent. Not only do these elected officials get their salaries and wages from our tax dollars, but then they also get these benefits. And I mean, let's face it, if this was another country, we would call that a bribe. But because of the political system here and because of, you know, some kind of arcane laws, we can't call it a bribe. But it's as simple as being handed cash and then doing whatever the person that just handed you the cash says to do.
Anything else you'd like to add?
We need more and more people to be brave and courageous in their support. We know there's so many people, especially within the Jewish community that we've heard from, that have been facing all kinds of harassment and intimidation from Zionists within their community, even within the Christian community. I'm speaking as a faith leader, and it just really pains my heart to see that there are people that are so hateful out there in this world that can't or won't allow their own people, sometimes it's within their own household, to simply just call for peace. That's what we're here for. We're not here calling for, you know, a violent end or death to anyone. We're here trying to promote the preservation of life. And that's the irony in all of this, is that you have people that want a genocide to continue. As we can see, either the Israeli army is totally incompetent or they're a bunch of liars. You can't kill that many people and say that you've done the job when that many people are all civilians. As we can see, rockets are still being fired, which means they have not cleared out or achieved any of their stated military objectives. So, like I said, they're either wholly incompetent, which means the United States government, President Biden, is funding an incompetent army who are enacting war crimes, which, by the way, the war crimes report was due yesterday, and it's indefinitely delayed, and Congress is not happy about that. But if they're not wholly incompetent and they are well-trained, then that means they are just lying about the number of people that they've killed. They claim to have one of the best, I don't know how this can be the best, but one of the most moral civilian to combatant death ratios. And just simple mathematics, simple statistics, and just hearing from the victims themselves on the grounds, the people that have been left behind who've lost all their family, that can't be further from the truth. I would say at this point, it's over 85% of civilian casualties. And honestly speaking, no one really knows how many Hamas fighters there are, but we do know how many civilians there are. And we do see how many civilians have their homes bombed and their families bombed day after day after day. As I'm speaking to you right now, at least 10 children are dying this hour. And I just don't see how the world can be quiet about that.
Yeah, so my name is Dr. Sahib Chikima, and we're here obviously as part of the you know, the protests here. And in addition to just coming here protesting, obviously we're still asking for a ceasefire, and we want to show support for the students around, you know, the globe, not just the country, and the amazing things they're doing. And all they're asking for is to save lives. So we're here. This is not the first time that actually we're coming out. Now we have even more reason, because things are getting worse by the day. And also we're, you know, I personally am here volunteering, trying to collect petition signatures for both Dr. Jill and Dr. West. And the reason we want to do that is we really want to show what democracy is. And you know, we're tired of the two-party system where you only have one of the two. And, you know, sometimes we say the least of the two evils. That should not be an option for people. People should choose, you know, those that reflect, you know, their principles, their belief, not necessarily religious belief, but belief in the system. And I personally, I'm still trying to figure out who am I going to vote for. But that's irrelevant right now. I just want people to know that, hey, once you're coming out, because a lot of people are saying we're not going to vote, that's not the answer, right? You have a voice, use it. So what is better than giving them more than two options? And we're hoping at least one of the candidates that we're collecting signatures for will make it into the ballot. I know the number right now is 45,000 signatures, which means we have to collect about 90,000, but we're working on it. So that's what we're trying to do in addition to the protest.
This has been Mark Dunley for the Hudson Mohawk Magazine. So I will say the rally organizers spend a fair amount of time explaining that the chant "From the River to the Sea" is not about destroying Israel or getting rid of all the Jewish inhabitants. It is about peace for everyone. We will have on Hudson Mohawk Magazine two additional reports from this rally in the coming days.
So for our peace bucket, we turn to the early advocates of Mother's Day envisioned it as a day of peace to honor and support mothers who lost sons and husbands to the carnage of the Civil War. Marsha Hopple talks to Mark Dunley about the 21st annual Grannies for Peace Vigil this Saturday at the Tulip Festival in Albany. The theme is Gaza. Send food, not bombs.
For our peace segment, we are talking with Marsha Hopple, and for 21 years, Grannies for Peace have had a presence at the annual Tulip Fest in Albany, which starts on Saturday, May 11th. So Marsha, can you tell us about this event and why you're still doing it 21 years later?
Thanks, Mark. I'm one of the many members of Women Against War, and Grannies for Peace is a project of Women Against War. And yes, the women have showed up rain or shine, and that'll still be the case if it's raining on Saturday at the Tulip Festival in downtown Albany each year around Mother's Day. And it's really Mother's Day that we kind of are triggered by. Anyway, our theme this year is Gaza, send food, not bombs. I guess, and the answer to your question, Mark, is about why we keep showing up is because, unfortunately, there's always wars and there's always terrible things about war happening to women and children, especially, that we focus on. So there will be, 20 to 30 of us. And then this year, we're lucky to have at least a couple women from the new Upper Hudson Valley chapter of Code Pink join us. Code Pink is a national women's organization for peace, and the Upper Hudson Valley will actually have their own vigil after ours at 2:30 in about the same spot. What else can I answer for you?
Well, I assume this has been going on for 21 years, that the first event perhaps was tied to the wars going on in Iraq and Afghanistan at that point.
That's right. We had tried other things like a fast for peace that went on for 102 days, but we just decided to form Grannies for Peace and start doing about three actions, maybe four a year, one of which is always at the Tulip Festival. It's an enormous crowd. So we get a lot of people who ask us questions. We hand out leaflets that, for instance, this year would help people understand things like the horrors in Gaza, and that we're opposed to that, and that the leaflet will call on the U.S. to not send the bombs that are raining down on Gaza. Things like that are what we try to accomplish.
Now, are you looking for participants, grannies, to join you at this event? And Grannies of Peace, are grannies one of the groups that sing?
No, not this grannies. I think there's a grannies group that does sing. Ours does not. Ours has women in it who have gotten to be almost 100 years old in the time we've been doing this, by the way, and they keep coming, like Pat Beadle, for instance, in her wheelchair. But we welcome people of all ages to join us. Yes, it's one reason to make sure people like you know about it and get the word out, is that we welcome people of all ages, and we always get a lot of attention from people of all ages when we're there with our signs. Grannies provides the signs. It's kind of a quiet vigil. It's not loud like some Gaza vigils are or other causes, but we get a lot of looks and a lot of engagement with the people going by with our leaflets and just having conversations. And lately with social media, people come up and take their picture with us too, which at first seemed very strange to us, but now we enjoy it.
Is there a particular location where you do this event in Washington Park?
Well, there's a very, very large towering Moses statue in the park in the midst of many of the tulips. It's not far from Madison Avenue, near Madison Avenue, edge of the park, and a little bit east of there on the grass, outside of the area where all the vendors are and the food trucks and so forth. It's near the statue. So that's how to find us. If you're not familiar with the park, I'm certainly happy to have people call me to get help in finding us. Do you want me to give my number?
Sure.
If you want help with what's going on and you need directions, it's Marcia at 518-283-5353.
And what will some of the literature that you'll be handing out this weekend say, or points that it will make?
It'll make the point that this is just a horrible starvation situation and other terrible things about the situation in Gaza. It'll call on the U.S. not to send the bombs that are raining down on Gaza. A third point will be for the U.S. to restore funding to UNRWA, the United Nations Refugee Agency, which was accused by Israel of engagement with Hamas. And then the fourth point, and this is all still being written up and it will be printed at the last minute, some of the details, is a call for ceasefire, of course. The U.S. keep pressure on Israel to find a way to a ceasefire.
Now, since you've been doing this for 21 years, has the crowd's reaction to this event changed over time?
Yeah, that was probably the most obvious thing about the change over time to us, is that we may not be as actively on social media as a lot of the people that go by. So at first, when people would stop and take our picture, but also hand their camera to their friend and come up and get in the picture with us, we thought that was very strange and kind of inappropriate. But it actually turned out to be delightful. I mean, people would come up and get their picture taken, and we assume send it on to somebody else, showing the signs that say what our theme is that year, like Black Lives Matter or whatever the theme was in any given year. And so we realized that this is a good thing. And then sometimes we'd get into conversation. We've always had conversations with people, but depending on, you know, because we have some women, some grannies go out more into the sidewalk and offer leaflets and talk to people. We have seen more of that, I think, in recent years.
And what are some of the other things that Women Against War are doing these days?
Well, we're starting to plan for this summer. We usually go to the food festival at the Empire State Plaza, talk about crowds. That's another time we get big crowds. And we go on some theme. We'll see what that would be this summer. But we're going to try to plan something with this new chapter of Code Pink. Very eager younger women are getting started on that. So we helped hold up signs and take signs to their recent event at the Troy Farmers Market, their first action that they had planned up here in the Upper Hudson Valley. And they're also going to have an action this Saturday after Women Against Worse, right on the same spot and at 2:30, where they are also protesting the situation in Gaza and have their own, I think their theme is Mourning Mothers, MOURNING, mothers, in the case of Gaza killing so many civilians. And they'll hang out or lay out on the ground children's clothing that shows the fact that children are dying under the rubble many times in Gaza. So we're planning things like that, trying to get a speaker about China and trying to keep China from being demonized and dismissed as a potential partner for many good purposes in this globe. I think that probably answers your question about the kinds of things we do are often speakers or standing at the corner of Wolf Road and Central Avenue with signs about something that is a problem and getting the attention of people in their cars.
So we only have about a minute left, so I'll ask a bunch of questions. You can answer what you want. Can you remind us that the time on Saturday, May 11th, this has been 21 years. Are you discouraged or encouraged that you're still doing this after 21 years? And if people want to connect more with Women Against War, Grannies of Peace, how best to do that in 30 seconds?
Well, Women Against War has a website, womenagainstwar.org. And that's a good way to go, if you want to do an email, write to info@womenagainstwar.org. The time on Saturday is at 2 p.m. Come a little early so you can find us and so that you can get a sign to hold and get in position with us. I think I'm encouraged about the fact that this new chapter of Code Pink has started. And so we'll have kind of a successor organization, I hope, to keep pushing the U.S. to have better foreign policy positions.
Well, thank you very much, Marsha Hopple, Grannies of Peace. And Saturday, May 11th, this has been Mark Dunley for the Hudson Mohawk Magazine. So we do our peace segment at least every Wednesday. One thing we forgot to point out is that the women dress all in white, which is probably why people want to take their picture. And also, as we said in the introduction, Mother Day initially was a day of peace. Basically, mothers not wanting to see their, particularly sons, go off and die in war. And we will have somebody on from Code Pink in the near future. But for those of you just tuning in, I'm still Mark Dunlap.
And I'm still Sina Bazila Hickey, and you're listening to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine on the Hudson Mohawk Radio Network on WOOC LP 105.3 FM Troy, WOOG LP 92.7 FM Troy, WOOS LP 98.9 FM Schenectady, WOOA LP 106.9 FM Albany, WCAA LP 107.3 FM Albany, and streaming online at mediasanctuary.org. This program comes from the Sanctuary for Independent Media in Troy, New York.
And I feel we should mention that Joan Eason still is our engineer at the boards. But if you like what you hear, you can support this program by sharing our content. You can find today's stories and more at mediasanctuary.org.
While planting native plant species and shrinking your grassy areas around your home to make room for flower beds is relaxing and beautifying, it is also an important way to fight back against climate change and environmental degradation. Rosemary Armeo talks with Judith Federle for this week's Armeo on the Brink.
I'm Rosemary Armeo, the host of On the Brink, with a sample from this week's podcast, On the Brink of Blooming Gardens. It features 86-year-old Professor Emerita and Master Gardener Judith Federling explaining why shrinking your lawn and putting in flower beds could be the most powerful thing you do to help the environment. Our full podcast is available on YouTube, Apple, and all other podcast channels. I want to talk about grass. How the heck did this become the favorite plant of America? Why not dandelions, a whole yellow lawn instead of green grass? Grass is, it's boring. It doesn't do anything for bees. And yet we cultivate it. We throw poison on it to kill everything else so it thrives. How did this happen? Judith?
Well, the current situation, the suburban lawn is a relatively recent development. If you go back and look at our gardening books from the 1800s, what they talk about grasses as kind of multiple species of native plants that form a lawn. So this is a relatively new development, and I think it has a lot to do with the way in which the American dream has become connected to the home, the self-standing home. Even though vast percentage of our population lives in cities, if you think about what is the American dream, how do you know you've achieved the American dream? You have a home, freestanding home with a nice front lawn, and the front lawns of the whole neighborhood connect, giving you the kind of illusion of community. They almost replace the old-fashioned commons that used to be in the middle of towns, you know, which we don't have anymore, but they are a sign of community. They are a sign of success. And honestly, I campaign against excessive lawns, but I'm not kill all the lawns fan at all. I think lawns have much to recommend them. I mean, they're actually, those non-native European turf grasses are quite beautiful as plants if you ever get down and actually look at them individually. And the lawns, especially the backyards, work to provide play spaces, barbecue spaces, all kinds of other spaces. The thing is, we don't need as much of it. We have way more lawn than we need. And part of the reason for that is because people don't have to maintain their own lawns. They just hire it out. Somebody else comes, usually somebody who knows nothing about plants. They come at 8 o'clock in the morning, even though it's a terrible time to cut the lawn. They come every week, even though the lawn doesn't need it, and they slash the lawn to shreds. Then the grass doesn't grow, so they have to come and pour poisons on it, you know, to get the grass to grow. You know, it's a terrible, terrible situation, and absolutely at the top of my list of things that should change. But that's why I call my talk Shrink the Lawn.
Right, not eliminate it.
Get rid of it entirely.
Okay, why is 8 o'clock in the morning a terrible time to cut grass? I did not know this.
Yeah, well, it's not dried off. You know, the grass has to have time to dry off, and you don't want to be cutting it wet. It just mats and tangles, and it doesn't get a clean cut. It's bad for the grass. It doesn't recover as well. Mm-hmm. You definitely want to wait. Best time is in the late afternoon.
And how about you, Barbara? You don't have much lawn. I've been to your house. You prefer gardens. Nope. Did it have a lawn when you first got there?
Well, when we first got here, the house was built into a hill, and there really wasn't much of anything. So we've been adding material to create what at first was a lawn. And then slowly, as I got into gardening, I kept saying to my husband, "Do you think we can make that bed a little bigger and eliminate more lawn?" And he's like, "You bet." But the other bad thing you didn't mention, Rosemary, about lawns is the combustion engine. You know, all that fossil fuel. I mean, you can have electric mowers, but, you know, they're smelly and it's just horrible. But I do think a beautiful lawn can accent a garden. And it is a nice place, you know, if you want to play croquet or you want the kids to have a little place to play. But I don't think it should be the majority of the property. You know, if you look at the houses in England, when you pull up, it's gravel. There's no lawn. All the garden is behind the house. Right. It's a completely different concept, and I love that. Mm-hmm. You know, but
you can tell that both of my guests, Judith Federley and Barbara Knuffer, not only are great gardeners, but have designed gardens. So you've taken a look at how lawns and flower beds interact, which is what we're really talking about now. There is a movement to help the ecology, which we know is failing, to help pollinators, to help birds by shrinking lawns, or by pulling up some of your lawn and replacing it with basically flowers. I love Rebecca McMacklin, if I'm saying her name right. She's the horticulturist who is responsible for the Brooklyn Bridge Park in New York City. An amazing one. She gives TED Talks, if anybody's interested. And she talks about how a lot of damage to the environment has been done in the name of gardening, because we put in plants that are not... Nurseries don't even sell a lot of native plants. They're beginning to, but they don't. We put in exotics. We've used chemicals to keep it clean. So for the sake of a garden, we're hurting the environment when all we really need to do is just plant more native flowers and plants. Can you both talk about that a little? I know you both know a lot about it. Start with Barbara.
Yeah, I think the biggest issue with putting in native plants is you have to respect the pH of your soil. I know that sounds technical and fancy, but in our area, most of the native plants like an acidic soil. They're growing in an evergreen forest. I do believe in the elderbergs that the pH is a little bit higher, but in general, so if you are going to introduce natives, they're not as easy as, you know, you have to do a little bit of research into what their requirements are. But the wonderful thing about them is they bloom and they fruit when the native wildlife needs them to. I realized that when I saw my garden had so many magnolias and things that were not, you know, they were from Japan. And I'm thinking, no wonder, you know, it really would be nice to have a winterberry type of holly that's native. And then the birds just love it. You won't believe the birds you get in the winter that come to that bush. Mm-hmm. So it really is tied to the native, the birds, the animals, and also shelter. So you might not want to do fussy little native plants. You might want to do more native shrubs that flower and then form fruit. But start with the soil. It always starts with the soil.
It's easy to find the pH of your soil. You can bring it to the center in Voorheesville that Judith has been talking about. And you probably have something similar in the Troy area, Barbara, where bring in a little 2 cups of dirt in a plastic bag, dried out, and they put some chemicals in, and it can tell you very quickly what your pH is and how to amend it to make it more or less acidic. So it's not hard at all. It's one of those things that gardeners make it look hard, but it really isn't, I think. Tell us more about native plants and how they're not just great for the environment, they are, and birds and bees love them, and butterflies, that changes your garden. But they're also just pretty in themselves. They're completely set for this environment, and they come in all different colors and shapes. Can you tell us about some, Judah?
Yeah, let me just add to the soil testing thing that there actually is a technique to testing the soil. And so anybody who is interested in doing a soil test through CCE should call and get the instructions, because it has to be taken up in a certain way and handled in a certain way before we can give you any kind of valuable information about your soil test. But absolutely, that's a good thing to do. And the other thing I would say about natives before, I'm gonna refer to something important here, but before I forget, the other thing about natives is they don't need the water.
Important.
They use so much unnecessary water to keep the exotic plants alive, because they're not from this climate, and so they don't handle the conditions that we have here very well. And we're spending a lot of time watering plants that, if we had more native plants, we wouldn't need to maintain them so much. We wouldn't need to have so many what they call in the industry inputs into maintaining. Mm-hmm. So it's always a question of inputs and outputs. And that's very much the case with lawn care. I mean, Barbara mentioned the horrible outputs of the carbon that's spewed by these lawnmowers.
So Judith Federley is certainly well known in the Capital District as a master gardener. I subscribe to her, I guess it's a newsletter that she sends out. But when I first encountered Judith in the early 80s, when I was part of the effort at SUNY Albany Free Off Campus Association to provide better security for women living off campus, I discovered that she was part of this very important women's, I guess, collective of feminist scholars at SUNY Albany. And it is quite well known nationally for her academic work on feminism. But you can listen to Omeo on the Brink, the full podcast, on your favorite podcast, Spotify, whatever. Omeo on the Brink.
And on May 6th, at the Albany Common Council meeting, several people spoke during the public comment period about the current issues facing the Civilian Complaint Review Board. The people of Albany voted in a referendum for an independent and strong board to manage effective police oversight. However, many people have felt that the mayor's office had not cooperated, and the police department themselves had very clearly blocked the board. The first to speak was outgoing board member Kevin Canizzaro.
I think first off, in regard to Local Law D, you know, the board is at a really critical moment. What you all do in the next really few months, but as much as 8 months, is going to set the path for the success of the Community Police Review Board. And I think, you know, at the outset, I just want to express my strong support for the continued operations of the board and for the passage of Local Law D for 2024. Which you all consider. This is going to be my last week as a member of the Community Police Review Board. Unfortunately, the mayor decided not to renew my appointment. We got word by email on Thursday for the first time that my appointment would not be renewed. So, you know, I think it's incumbent upon me to thank the council. I would have liked to move forward, but I think it's important for me to express my, you know, thanks to this body for, you know, consistently showing their support where they can and, you know, pushing back where needed to make sure the board properly functions. My time working for the CPRB has been one of the more enriching experiences of my career so far. I really wish somehow we could make everybody, you know, sit in on some of our meetings, because as much as I had some general awareness of the really deep issues that exist in the city between the community and police, I think it took my experience on the board to really understand how deep that isn't going to change unless we have people willing to push against the status quo. And if my service on the board has done anything, it's invigorated my desire to, I hope for the rest of my career, work to ensure that in whatever way I can, this community has a good, but more importantly, a safe relationship with its police force. And I am encouraged by the membership who is on the CPRB. I know that these people can get it done. I know that this council wants to see real change in terms of the relations between the community and the police. And I think with your help, the board can get what we've all been seeking for a long time, which is true, independent, effective police oversight in the city of Albany.
Good evening. My name is Barbara Smith. I'm a resident of Latham, New York. But before that, I lived in Albany for approximately 37 years. And I was a representative on this Common Council representing the 4th Ward. During my two terms on the Common Council, I was vice chair of public safety, and then I was chair of public safety. So I have more than a passing knowledge of and interest in the functioning of the CPRB. What I have observed and continue to observe in different ways, conversations with people, and also by reading the New York Times a few weeks ago. I don't know how many people saw the article, which actually should make us all feel embarrassed. City's efforts to hold police accountable hit a wall, the police. And it talks about how Albany is one of those cities where the police department and also, in our case, the city government have done many, many things to prevent the CPRB from functioning the way that it is intended to function. To me, it is ironic that since Local Law J was passed in November of 2021, that there has been so much resistance to what looked like, finally, CPRB with teeth. And I hope that the council, which can serve as a counterweight to the elements that we're talking about that hold back the CPRB from being effective, I hope that you will take this into account when you have the opportunity to pass legislation, to speak out, and to make decisions about how we support our Community Police Review Board. Thank you.
Hi, my name is Ivy Morris. As the former chair of the board, I just want to talk about the situations that we find ourselves in now regarding the board. In 2021, as you all know, the board was not considered an independent entity. We found that there were a lot of situations that we could not address within our charge. So we worked really hard on the outside with advocates to move forward on the Local Law J, and I want to thank you all for your support. What I wanted to say today is that I'm extremely disappointed and a little bit at a loss as to what is starting to occur. I've gone to recent meetings, and I see that there are a lot of obstacles and a lot of pushback that is put in the board's way while they are moving toward independence, transparency, and accountability. I'm very disappointed in the fact that Kevin Canisero is no longer going to be a member of this board. I felt he brought a lot of energy and a lot of good, solid intelligence and brilliance to the board.
Good evening, Common Council members, members of the public. My name is Nairobi Vives. I am the chair of the Community Police Review Board. I I know that we are collectively striving for the same thing, for accountability and transparency, and this body as a whole has protected and uplifted and helped the board, and we are eternally grateful for that. I want the members of the public to be able to hear just how dire the situation is and what we are asking for from the Common Council and from the administration to support the CPRB. Our immediate challenge is finding a permanent home for the CPRB, which Local Law J legally requires to be independent. Since our board's inception, we have been fortunate to partner with Albany Law School for our administrative needs. However, our contract with the law school ends this year, and the CPRB needs a different structure. Integrating CPRB staff into the City of Albany government to become city employees would allow us to appoint an executive director. It would also allow us to rely on in-house, full-time investigators and administrative support, providing the freedom to work and onboard additional staff as needed. More importantly, we must ensure that this structure guarantees the CPRB independence operationally and fiscally. The CPRB's independence within the city cannot be influenced or perceived as influenced by political or other inappropriate factors. Any perception of outside influence or control will undermine the CPRB's value and confidence of the citizens of Albany. We expect our amendment to Local Law D to provide this independence. We hope that it passes and passes quickly with the changes needed to complete the transition process before the current contract with Albany Law School's Government Law Center expires in December of this year. So time is of the essence. As we share with the Public Safety Committee, this still leaves several logistical issues to be resolved, including but not limited to housing, staffing, onboarding, and hiring. All of these can occur collaboratively and under the auspices of a task force composed of council members and city and community representatives. I want to pause here momentarily to focus our attention on the urgency of the process. You've heard several people talk about the attacks or the impediments to our progress that we experience, and we've come before this body to talk about those a lot. So you all are familiar with many of the things that we talk about. The tasks that we have identified are numerous and complex. If we don't move forward expeditiously, we will be unable to provide the service that we promised our communities when they voted in favor of Local Law J. I'm asking you to recognize the weight of this effort and the inherent urgency as you decide how best to support independent police oversight for the people of Albany. Finally, I would be remiss. You heard from my colleague, Kevin Cannizzaro, and you heard that he has been removed while he was not an appointee of the Common Council. He was a mayoral appointee. He will be missed. Kevin was working very hard on this very issue that we're talking about, the introduction and the amendments to Local Law D to make the board's transition effective, efficient, and to provide oversight for the City of Albany with no notice, with no discussion, with no consideration of the work that he's doing. Kevin was removed. I want to say that he's been dedicated, passionate, engaged as a board member and a colleague. He has been unwavering in his service, and though his term has ended, we hope to continue with working with Kevin in whatever capacity is appropriate. Thank you so much for allowing me to speak.
Thank you.
So we want to thank Moses Nagel for filing that report on the Albany Community Police Review Board.
Our final story this week is Turquoise Takeover and Lung Cancer Action Week. To learn more about what this means and to understand more about lung cancer, Marshall Hildreth reached out to American Lung Association.
Hello, this is Marshall Hildreth reporting for Hudson Mohawk Magazine. Today I'm joined by Max McAuliffe, who is the American Lung Association's New York State Advocacy Manager for Clean Air Initiatives. Welcome to Hudson Mohawk Magazine, Max.
Hello, thank you for having me. I'm excited to be here.
We're so happy to have you. So starting off, can you tell us a little bit about the American Lung Association and your position?
So I, like you said, I'm the New York State Advocacy Manager for Clean Air Initiatives. And what that looks like is focusing specifically on, though I do touch federal and local policy, my expertise would specifically be New York State public policy, anything involving making sure that we have better air quality here in New York State. My role specifically involves bridging the gap between public health issues and environmental justice issues. And though, you know, that may seem like an inherent connection, a lot of the times in legislation, there is a big disconnect. So I'm here to bring more public health voices to the American Lung Association's table in terms of combating climate change and air pollution.
Awesome. That's right up the sanctuary's alley, combining environmental justice and, well, People's Health Sanctuary deals with public health, but that's awesome to hear other organizations are focusing on that. And today actually marks the middle of Lung Cancer Action Week. So that includes Turquoise Takeover. Can you tell us a little bit about that week and specifically your role in advocacy?
Is bringing awareness to lung disease, specifically lung cancer, across the nation. So you're going to see buildings, you know, government buildings, even private businesses, where they're going to light up turquoise. And at night, it just looks absolutely amazing. In New York State, there's going to be 13 sites, One World Trade Center, Niagara Falls, the Empire State Plaza, Penn Station, so on and so forth, that tonight they're going to light up turquoise to bring awareness to combating lung disease and lung cancer. We also asked during this week that we have like media personalities, reporters, et cetera, wear turquoise so that it can bring further awareness to combating lung disease.
Yeah, that's awesome. And our listeners can't see, but I have a little blue fit on right now. But something I wasn't aware, and I guess this week is supposed to kind of bring attention to, is that lung cancer is the leading cause of cancer-related deaths in the U.S. So that's kind of a lot of information to digest, or a lofty sentence to digest. Can you kind of put that into perspective for us?
Yes, absolutely. Like you just said, lung cancer is the leading cause of cancer death, not just in New York State, but nationally. And, you know, our State of the Air report, our 2024 State of the Air report just came out, but it's continuing, even though there's updated information, it's continuing the facts that we have, you know, from our 2023 State of the Air report, that though the new cases of lung cancer are improving in New York State, it's still actually higher than the national average. So that's what we do at the American Lung Association: education, advocacy, and research, which motivates our work in combating lung disease.
Wow. I did not realize it was that big of a percentage in New York State was above average. So when I think of lung cancer, though, typically I think of, you know, your traditional chain smoker or maybe, you know, a coal miner or something. But what are like other contributing factors, or is it kind of that plain and simple?
Typically at the American Lung Association, we, you know, want to bring attention to a wide range of, you know, lung cancer comes to mind immediately, but we call it lung disease because, for example, in June of 2023, as you know, we had in New York State, you know, was incredibly affected by the Canadian wildfires. And we saw an increase of cases of, you know, children that had pre-existing asthma, but also obtained asthma-like conditions because of the Canadian wildfires and emergency department visits in the Bronx specifically. Pretty much exploded. It was a clear example of how public health issues and environmental justice come, you know, hand in hand. And, you know, also people who had pre-existing COPD, the wildfires, you know, had a tremendous effect on them. That's basically my role, is to make sure that those issues are brought to the forefront. And this doesn't even include people who discovered they had long COVID because of the wildfires. And they also had to go to the emergency department at hospitals and realize how moving forward tremendously affected their breathing is going to be just by, you know, little changes to the environment. Not to say that the wildfires were little, of course, but moving forward, you know, that's why integrating environmental justice initiatives is crucial.
Absolutely. And that includes like a lot of factors that you mentioned that I don't think are on the top of people's minds, especially, you know, going to asthma or COPD. And that kind of brings me to my next question. Because you mentioned these contributing environmental factors, specifically like wildfires, you know, we think about, you know, car emissions, pollution, living in especially low income and environmentally disadvantaged neighborhoods, which North Central Troy is. What are some other ways the ALA is trying to advocate for environmental justice and relating it to advocacy around lung disease?
Thank you. So I want to bring attention to specifically a bill that we have been giving a lot of attention to. It's the it's called PRIA, the P-R-R-I-A, the Packaging Reduction and Recycling Infrastructure Act. This is a New York State bill that focuses on, you know, it would be ignorant of me to not focus on the air is connected to the soil is connected to the water. It's one big giant interacting circle. So the bill specifically would focus on plastic incineration, and it would require companies, businesses, you know, corporations that if they produce packaging material or they contract with companies that are creating, again, the packaging materials and supplies, that they would have to, it would be mandated to collaborate with coalitions, groups that would assist them in moving forward in the reduction and recycling of plastic waste, because it also focuses on regulating how they incinerate their plastic and waste incinerators. And, you know, I mean, that's not even just air quality. That's, again, you know, it goes into the air, and then the natural filtration cycle between the water and the air gets in our water. And then it also affects our children, because we're also focusing on the lung disease that is obtained, not even just through air pollution, but the plastics that are in, For example, Lunchables. You know, there's a fight right now. A consumer report just came out that focuses on the toxic chemicals that are in the plastics that hold Lunchables, like kids' food.
It never ceases to amaze me just how interconnected all these issues end up being, and especially how everything relates to our day-to-day. You know, you speak of Lunchables, but kind of speaking to day-to-day, things we might be able to do to not only support awareness around lung disease, but maybe some small things we can do to be preventative about it. If you could tell us a little bit about what ALA might have going on in the region for this week.
Yeah, we in Purchase, New York, we're going to have a Lung Force Walk, which brings attention to lung cancer and also just lung disease as a whole. And it's in the Hudson Valley. If you can go to lungforce.org/Hudson Valley, that's all together, no space in Hudson Valley. Again, lungforce.org/Hudson Valley. And you can sign up for a walk that is going to take place on June 15th at 9:30 a.m. It's going to be at Manhattanville College. Yeah, it's going to be great. There's going to be a ribbon cutting ceremony with the walk start, and there's going to be a barbecue on the field for everyone. So we really encourage you to come out and bring awareness to lung disease and lung cancer.
Thank you so much, Max. We really appreciate you coming on Hudson Mohawk Mag to tell us a little bit about Lung Cancer Action Week.
Thank you so much for having me.
And for more information, you can check out www.lung.org.
And that's our show. We hope you've enjoyed this episode of the Hudson Mohawk Magazine. I'm Sina Pazila-Hickey.
And I'm Mark Dunley. We want to thank Joan Eason as our engineer and all the other wonderful team, Moses Nagel, Rosemary Armeo, Zachary Grady, and Marshall Hildreth. And thanks to you, our listeners, for making this all worthwhile.